Today is Tuesday, August 31st, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinuro for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. exits Afghanistan after 20 years of war.
The Taliban, ousted by the U.S. in 2001, now celebrating with gunfire in the streets.
Plus, Ukraine's president visits Washington.
Ukraine's president Vladimir Zelensky has been waiting for 2 years to visit the White House.
Also, UN marks the end of cancer-causing leaded gasoline. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. It's August 31st, the deadline imposed by President Joe Biden for U.S. forces to be out of Afghanistan. At least 122,000 people were evacuated by the U.S. military and coalition forces, 5,400 of them Americans. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb has the latest. The
military mission is over. A new diplomatic mission has begun.
The Taliban, ousted by the U.S. in 2001, now celebrating with gunfire in the streets, with the general overseeing the withdrawal speaking soberly to Pentagon reporters.
There's a lot of heartbreak associated with this departure. We did not get everybody out that we wanted to get out.
The U.S. has moved its diplomatic mission to Qatar and is vowing to help those left behind depart in the coming days. About 250 Americans and countless Afghans who helped America's cause.
Many are still there. Our commitment to them has no deadline.
The total casualties during the evacuation remain unclear, including Afghans killed in the initial evacuation chaos, 13 U.S. service members and more than 100 Afghans killed in an Islamic State attack Thursday, and more Afghans killed Sunday in subsequent explosions after the U.S. military blew up a suspected Islamic State vehicle-borne bomb.
A day or a week where you lose 13 service members is the worst day or the worst week of your presidency.
White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said the president stands by his decision to withdraw. About 2,400 service members died in Afghanistan during the 20 years of war. The U.S. killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and prevented al-Qaeda terrorists from launching another attack against the American homeland. But it ultimately failed to build a government and military capable of defeating the Taliban, causing many Americans to fear that the gains made by several Afghan groups, such as women and girls, could be lost. And the lives of those who aided Americans could now be in jeopardy. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The last U.S. soldiers left Afghanistan last night, ending the longest armed conflict in the history of the United States. The U.S. fought terrorism in Afghanistan for 20 years and was confronted with terrorism during the last days of the U.S. military presence there. David DeRoche, associate professor of the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the problem of terrorism in Afghanistan with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Really shows is the difficulty of trying to combat a multinational threat when you're dealing with an area where borders are fluid. So what we had in Afghanistan was always a small operation. We never occupied the country the way that we occupied Germany or Japan after World War II, for example. We always tried to move through local intermediaries. We never actually had the troops on the ground to actually impose governance the way you have to effectively combat a terror organization. And at the same time, the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is extremely fluid. The Pakistani government doesn't have control over that border. The Afghan government never has. So what you had were multinational terrorist movements that simply moved over. You know, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan. What we're seeing is, I think, a phenomena that you have people with a pre-modern ideology, in this case, anti-Western, that claims roots in Islam, but they're taking advantage of modern technology, internet communications, global communications to inspire and recruit people in other countries, international flights. And this is just the new world order. And this terrorist threat is going to be with us for a long time. But the initial indications are not good. It appears as though these organizations are quickly reestablishing a presence in Afghanistan. And that's going to be a challenge for the Biden administration going forward.
The U.S. was satisfied originally with its operations in the past against ISIS-K inside Afghanistan. Why has it become the highest terrorist threat after all these years?
ISIS-K, like most insurgent groups, doesn't need a whole lot of people or a whole lot of infrastructure in order to maintain itself, you know, in a system of viability. When you have a chaotic situation, which the Taliban claims to be in control of Kabul, but really isn't, and you have a determined adversary, and you have a lot of, you know, civilian population moving around, people that disguise themselves as civilians find that very easy to exploit. So ISIS-K was not considered to be defeated. It was considered to be in a dormant state, where it was still watched closely and where targets were identified, they were probably taken out. They fight actively with the Taliban. They consider each other as heretics. So the Taliban has no great love for them. So in terms of ISIS-K, the attack at the airport was a twofer. It discredited the Taliban's claim to be a functioning government in Afghanistan, and it struck a blow at American forces. And from their perspectives, that's about as good as it gets.
If there was one issue in the United States that united Republicans and Democrats alike during both the primary campaign leading to the 2020 U.S. presidential election and the election campaign itself, it was the bipartisan commitment to ending the era of endless wars. What is the way forward for the U.S. to combat international terrorism?
You know, the U.S. is tired of endless wars, but you always have to remember the Stalin quote, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." Unfortunately, what we're seeing is a movement that has a religious sheen to it, but it's not dissimilar from the anarchist movement of the late 19th, early 20th century. You have people who are dissatisfied with the international order, and it's only natural to expect that people who are dissatisfied in the 1890s, they call themselves anarchists. Later on, they called themselves communists and revolutionaries. Now they call themselves Islamists. But the motivation is all the same. It's a dissatisfaction with their place in the world order and then a willingness to take violent action against those who they see as imposing this world order. So this is a state of nature. It's going to be chronic. It's not something that you can solve with one attack like in a movie. My biggest concern is that it appears as though now there is a country in which these organizations will be able to operate at will. And if that is the case, that will be a serious problem for the United States and for its partners and for really anybody who opposes these groups, be they in the West or not, going forward. And it's going to be a problem for a number of years.
That's my colleague, Mohammed Elshenawy, speaking with David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. The United Nations Security Council on Monday passed a resolution that calls on the Taliban to honor its commitments to allow Afghans and foreign nationals to leave the country. The resolution passed with 13 countries in favor, none against, but Russia and China abstained. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said, quote, "It is imperative that the international community remain unified and resolute, including and holding the Taliban accountable for all its commitments," unquote. The resolution also calls for unhindered humanitarian access and that the human rights of women and minorities be protected.
As Afghanistan enters the next chapter, it is imperative that the international community remain unified and resolute, including in holding the Taliban accountable for its commitments. One such commitment which the Taliban has made publicly and privately is that those who wish to leave Afghanistan will be able to do so. Today's resolution signals just how seriously the Security Council takes that commitment, along with the commitments to allow humanitarian aid to flow and prevent terrorism.
You know, we were disappointed with the abstentions of Russia and China. I will tell you that within the P5, we consulted very closely. We took into account some of the concerns that both the Chinese and the Russians raised in the draft resolution that was eventually approved. So the fact that they abstained, I think they will have to explain themselves, but I think the Security Council spoke strongly, and what's in the resolution, I think, are issues that are important to every single member of the Security Council, including China and Russia. Look, we're not in a place yet where we are prepared to recognize the Taliban. They haven't even formed a government yet. So we need to see what kind of government they form. We insist that that government be inclusive and that it allows for the participation of women and that it takes into consideration as it forms itself the rights of all Afghans, including minorities. So we will see what kinds of actions they take before any decisions are made about recognition.
That's the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Pakistan's Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmad said on Monday the Taliban have assured his government they won't allow Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, TPP militants in Afghanistan, to carry out attacks on Pakistan. The TTP, an Islamic militant umbrella organization that renewed an allegiance to the Afghan Taliban after the fall of Kabul, recently stepped up its campaign against the Pakistani army. This as the U.S. completed its troops withdrawal from Afghanistan after 2 decades of war. For the mood across the border in Pakistan, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Goh.
It's like a sigh of relief for Pakistan in terms of the problems the government here had with the ousted government in Kabul. The relationship was very tense, and Pakistan kept accusing the then government that it was together with India was creating problems, and they were nurturing anti-Pakistan militants on the Afghan soils to create security challenges for Pakistan. So at least there is a relief that now a government is in place or an administration in place in Kabul, which is obviously friendly for reasons that many of the Taliban leaders who lived here among the Afghan refugee population in Pakistan, orchestrating or planning the insurgent activities across the border in Afghanistan against U.S.-led foreign forces and Afghan forces. So that an expectation in Pakistan is sort of support that was given to the Taliban, that it will be reciprocated by the Taliban now, that at least there will be no illegal activity out of Afghan soil against Pakistan. This is what is being expected.
Ayaz, there are reports that the Taliban gave assurances to the Interior Minister of Pakistan. Can you speak to what these assurances are and what is in it for Pakistan?
Although the Interior Minister of Pakistan has not spoken about the kind of assurances Taliban have given to Pakistan, he made just a general statement at a news conference today. But what Voice of America was able to find out a few days ago is that the Afghan Taliban have created a 3-member high-level commission in Afghanistan, which has been tasked to go and talk to the anti-Pakistan militants who are basically working under the umbrella of this outlawed organization called the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is commonly known as Pakistani Taliban. So the Afghan Taliban Commission, 3-member commission, is now talking to the Pakistani Taliban on Afghan soil who have been sheltering there for years to persuade them to lay their arms and go back to Pakistan and reconcile with the government there so that there is no violence and that Afghan soil is not used by them anymore for attacks against Pakistan. So it is a significant development because this high-level commission that we know is working to help Pakistan overcome this militant threat is quite influential. And if the Afghan Taliban fail to deliver on their commitment of reining in or preventing these terrorist groups from operating out of Afghanistan, then that will raise questions about the Taliban's commitment that they have given to the United States in the peace agreement that the two signed last year, which obviously led to the withdrawal of American forces. And in that agreement, the Taliban have promised that no transnational terrorist group will be allowed to use Afghanistan for international terrorism against the United States, its allies, or against the neighboring countries.
That's VOA's Ayaz Goh speaking with me from Islamabad. This is the Voice of America. In the U.S., Louisiana communities battered by Hurricane Ida are facing a new danger, the possibility of weeks without power in the stifling late summer heat. Ida ravaged the region's power grid, leaving the entire city of New Orleans and hundreds of thousands of other state residents in the dark with no clear timeline on when power would return. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said 25,000 utility workers are in the state to help restore electricity, with more on the way. The storm left some communities under more than 2 meters of water, but so far, fewer than 10 deaths have been confirmed. Rescue workers continue to search through flooded or flattened buildings. A Bangladesh lawyer says an anti-terrorism tribunal on Tuesday sentenced six Islamist militants to death in the brutal slaying of 2 men, including a prominent gay rights activist 5 years ago. In April 2016, assailants had to death Kohaz Manan, an editor of Bangladesh's first gay rights magazine who had worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and his friend Mahbub Rabai Tanoi. The killing in Dakar were part of a wave of attacks targeting atheists, moderates, and foreigners. Saudi TV says that a bomb-laden drone had targeted an airport in southwestern Saudi Arabia, wounding 8 people and damaging a civilian plane. It's the latest assault on the kingdom amid its grinding war in Yemen. There were no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. The second such strikes on the Aba airport in 24 hours. The earlier attack caused no casualties.
This is Science in a Minute.
Did you know that the oxygen that sustains our lives has only been around for the last 2.3 to 2.5 billion years? Scientists theorize that microorganisms called cyanobacteria, living in Earth's oceans, began releasing oxygen through photosynthesis to create the permanently oxygenated atmosphere we depend on today. New research from the universities of Washington and Michigan, along with colleagues from other universities, suggests volcanic activity may have helped Earth get its first puffs of oxygen 2.5 billion years ago. The researchers studied some ancient Australian rocks and found that frequent volcanic eruptions at that time may have helped fuel the explosive growth in the number of these oxygen-producing ancient marine microorganisms. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Australian drug regulators have approved the use of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 12 to 15. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation has advised the federal government that the Pfizer vaccine is safe and effective for children ages 12 to 15. The drug regulators have insisted that the benefits of COVID-19 vaccination for children of that age range far outweigh the potential risks, including myocarditis, where the heart muscle is inflamed. Australia's Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says he hopes most injections will be given by the end of the year.
We're in a position to ensure that all children and all families who seek their children to be vaccinated between the ages of 12 to 15 will be able to do so this year.
The Pfizer vaccine was already available to Australian Aboriginal children ages 12 to 15 who have underlying medical conditions or live in remote areas. France, Italy and Israel started offering the Pfizer vaccine to anyone aged 12 and older in June. Japan did so in May, and the United States recently approved the drug's use for that age group. The vaccines have been approved for children in India, but officials haven't decided when inoculations can begin. Paul Griffin, an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Queensland, supports Australia's decision to offer vaccines to younger children.
We have seen excellent data supporting the use of these vaccines in this age group. Other countries have started doing it, and we know it's an important age group to be vaccinated for so many reasons. Children are now increasingly recognised as contributing to the spread of this virus.
The Australian Medical Association also supports the vaccination of children, but has said that some older age groups are more of a priority. Teachers in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, face mandatory coronavirus vaccinations as authorities plan a return to school for students starting in late October. In Australia, 34.4% of the population is fully vaccinated. 4 weeks ago, it was 19.5%. 15 million Australians remain in lockdown, including residents in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra, as Delta variant infections continue to surge. New South Wales authorities reported 1,218 additional COVID-19 cases Sunday, a new daily record. Australia has detected about 50,000 coronavirus infections since the pandemic began, and 993 people have died, according to the health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Leaded gasoline has been eliminated after the world's last remaining stock were used up last month, the UN's environmental program UNEP said Monday. The agency had led a 19-year campaign to end use of lead in fuel because it poses major health and environmental risks. The UNEP says Algeria, the only country that was still pumping leaded petrol into vehicles, exhausted its final stocks in July. The agency said lead in fuel contaminates air, soil, and drinking water and can cause heart diseases, stroke, and cancer. Some studies have shown it harms brain development, especially in children, says Inga Anderson, UNEP executive director.
Leaded fuel illustrates, in a nutshell, the kind of mistakes that humanity has been making at every level of our societies. The kind of mistakes that have brought us to the triple planetary crisis, the crisis of climate change, the crisis of biodiversity loss, and the crisis of pollution. It is in the global response to leaded fuels shows that humanity can learn from and fix mistakes that we've made. We got where we are today thanks to this innovative public-private partnership for clean fuels and vehicles, the PCFV, for which UNEP provides a secretariat.
That's Inger Anderson, UNEP executive director. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is scheduled to visit the White House on Wednesday, September 1st. VOA's Ostap Yarish reports on the long-awaited meeting from Washington.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been waiting for 2 years to visit the White House. And finally, it is taking place. President Biden will meet Zelensky face-to-face in Washington. Ukraine's ambassador to the U.S., Oksana Makarova, sends an important message about the U.S.-Ukraine relationship.
After Chancellor Merkel, President Zelensky is the second leader the U.S. is inviting to the White House with a visit to discuss some strategic issues. So I believe it shows the level of attention, focus, and importance of our bilateral relations for both Ukraine and the United States.
Former U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, says the outcome of the meeting will depend to a great extent on Volodymyr Zelensky.
It seems to me, though, that part of the ability to make this a successful meeting will depend on what President Zelensky asks for. He should moderate some of his requests because if he asks too much, he may be disappointed. You do not want to ask the question unless you are sure the answer is going to be yes.
Among the more sensitive subjects is the issue of Ukraine's NATO membership and the country's opposition to the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia to Europe.
He should not expect any commitment from the United States regarding Ukraine and NATO. He should also not expect any change in the Biden position on Nord Stream 2.
Ukrainian Anti-Corruption Action Center Executive Director Daria Kalinyuk believes President Zelensky should remain assertive in discussing the Nord Stream 2 issue. She says the White House's decision to waive sanctions on Nord Stream 2 contradicts President Biden's statements on fighting corruption abroad.
The right thing would be to talk not only about corruption in Ukraine, but also about geopolitical corruption and strategic corruption. We can and should ask why Nord Stream 2 is being finished despite it being the symbol of strategic corruption.
Another important issue that could come up will be security cooperation. The White House has made the decision to support providing additional military aid to Ukraine. For Ostap Yarish in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
The president of the European Union's executive arm says the 27-nation bloc has reached its goal of getting 70% of adults in the EU fully vaccinated against the coronavirus over the summer. In a message posted Tuesday on Twitter, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen thanked, quote, the many people making this great achievement possible, unquote. The EU's COVID-19 vaccination campaign got off to a slow start due to supply shortages and delays, but now is among the most successful worldwide. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Brits could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the bit,
the African bit that counts.
The bit does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African bit.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.